Welcome to today's program titled The Defend Trade Secrets Act, What Employers Should Know Now. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Sifar Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only. You are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachment, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to the attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Robert Milligan.
Thank you, and thank you to the audience for joining us today. We're delighted to share with you today's program, the Defend Trade Secret Act, What Employers Should Know Now. Wanted to provide you a brief overview first about what we'd like to cover today. Let me introduce you to our panel. First, we have Dan Hart. He's a partner in our Atlanta, Georgia office of Sifar Shaw. Dan specializes in non-compete trade secret litigation as well as counseling. I'm also joined by Amy Abeloff. She's an attorney in our Century City office of Sifar Shaw. She's an attorney that specializes in trade secret as well as copyright and trademark issues. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of our trade secret non-compete and computer fraud group, and I'm based out of Century City. It's a very exciting time to be a trade secret lawyer with the passage of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And in a nutshell, what this act does is it creates a federal civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation. And in sort of the ramp up in addressing the media and putting together our management alert on this particular piece of legislation, we've been asked questions about how significant it is and what are the takeaways for companies and what do they need to know, particularly at the C-suite level. And I think that can be capitalized in two big takeaways. Number one, for companies that are looking to capitalize upon their intellectual property assets, they should really look at trade secrets now, because now you have a federal property right under the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And so companies that are looking for ways to maximize their intellectual property assets should now look to trade secrets. Number two, from a labor and employment and an HR perspective, there's particular language that should now be included in non-disclosure agreements as a result of this legislation. It has to deal with whistleblower immunity language, and we'll get into that as far as the best practices, as far as what magic language you should use, as well as what particular agreements that you should put it in. I would encourage you throughout this presentation to ask some questions. There's obviously a reason why you attended today's program, and we want to make sure that you get the best takeaway from the program. So I encourage you now to go ahead and ask your questions as far as what you hope to get out of this program, and we'll make sure that we try to cover it throughout the day, throughout today's program. With respect to the agenda, the history of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, it's very interesting. It started in 2012 with some legislation to federalize trade secret legislation, and it culminated with President Obama signing the Defend Trade Secrets Act on May 12th of this year. And it was a process that was really pushed by some of the senators, Senator Hatch out of Utah and Senator Coons out of Delaware. And at its end, it was a bipartisan, bicameral effort. And in our sort of do-nothing Congress, this is a remarkable piece of legislation where in the Senate, it was voted on unanimous consent, and there was only two dissenters in the House to the bill. So it had a tremendous amount of support. What we're talking about, what does the DTSA provide? You know, in a nutshell, it's providing the right for companies, trade secret owners, to avail themselves of federal court. In the past, if you wanted to pursue a trade secret claim, trade secrets were and are governed by state law. And there was the only way you could get to federal court is if you had diversity jurisdiction. Now you have an express right to go to federal court. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the unique provisions. Now, the Defend Trade Secret Act does not displace state law. So the Uniform Trade Secret Act that's been adopted by approximately 48 states in some manner is still on the books. And so now you can bring not only a federal claim for trade secret misappropriation, but also a state claim. But there are some unique provisions of the DTSA. Specifically, one of the exceptional aspects of the DTSA is the ability to obtain an ex parte seizure order. And what that means in a nutshell is that if you believe someone has misappropriated your trade secrets and you have sufficient proof, and you're able to dot your I's and cross your T's as far as all the procedural safeguards that are built into the statutes, you can obtain a seizure order so that a federal marshal, without notice to the defendant, would seize the alleged misappropriated trade secrets. And so it's quite an extraordinary remedy, and that's something that's not typically allowed under the laws, and it certainly distinguishes itself from the Uniform Trade Secret Act. There's also a whistleblower immunity provision of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, and this is something that's unique and separates it from the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And specifically, what's going on there is a specific statutory protection for whistleblowers to report potential violations of the law, suspected violations of the law, to law enforcement, government agencies, as well as to attorneys. And that's something that does not exist in the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And it's quite remarkable because a lot of the press that you're getting out of this new legislation is about the intellectual property aspects of it and creating this federal property right. But it's also remarkable in codifying this whistleblower protection. And I think that time will tell, but I think there may be aspects of the whistleblower protections that become more significant than the trade secret aspect of the legislation. We're going to get into some of the magic languages and the notices that are required so that you can leave this webinar with a better handling of what you need to do on a going forward basis. We're going to also address some strategies for litigation in light of this statute, you know, whether you should choose going to federal court or whether you should still go to state court in bringing your trade secret claims and some of the nuances as a result of the statute. And then finally, just sort of a general best practices going forward about what an employer business should do, you know, to effectively protect their trade secrets in light of the passage of this act. One of the chief driving aspects of the Defend Trade Secret Act was addressing the problem of the misappropriation of trade secrets and the perception that it was a tremendous problem that was impacting businesses in the United States as well as abroad. I'm sure the audience is well aware that the theft of trade secrets is a major concern to businesses globally, but I wanted to share some statistics with you that may be a bit surprising. A few years ago, Create.org and PricewaterhouseCoopers released a white paper that attempted to calculate the economic impact of trade secret theft globally. According to the study, trade secret theft costs anywhere between 1-3% of the GDP of the United States and other industrial economies. Similarly, in a study performed a few years ago for the European Commission, the European Commission reported that 1 in 5 businesses, or 20% of the businesses included in the study, reported that they had either suffered misappropriation or an attempted misappropriation of their trade secrets in the past 10 years. That number is quite astounding when one considers that the EU includes countries with some of the most advanced economies in the world, and the collective impact of such trade secret theft is easily in the billions of dollars in the EU alone. Putting aside these statistics, intuitively it does seem fairly clear that trade secret theft poses a major risk to companies in the United States and throughout the world. And these concerns were really what was at the heart of the Defend Trade Secret Act. One of the major constituents supporting the Defend Trade Secrets Act was DuPont, and they had that obviously highly publicized case in dealing with their proprietary Kevlar bulletproof armor, in which they took on a Korean company that they believed that misappropriated the trade secrets. And so they obtained congressional support in order to further their own interests, which is the support and the eventual passage of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And so these current concerns about trade secret theft were at the heart of not only the Defend Trade Secret Act, but also the Trade Secrets Directive, which is a similar piece of legislation that the European Union adopted last month and that we've discussed in our blog and in our prior webinars. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Amy Abeloff, who will give us an overview of the law prior to the Defend Trade Secrets Act, and then get into some of the nuts and bolts of what this new act is about and some of its key provisions.
Thanks so much, Robert, and thank you to everybody for attending our webinar today. So, going off of what Robert has just said, you're probably wondering, well, why exactly is the DTSA a big deal? The first important fact to know is that protection of trade secrets used to be primarily a function of state law. There are a handful of federal statutes, like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, otherwise known as the CFAA, that have some overlap with trade secrets misappropriation claims. However, there was previously no federal cause of action available to private litigants for trade secrets misappropriation prior to passage of the DTSA. The Economic Espionage Act, which I'll refer to by and large as the EEA, makes theft of trade secrets a federal criminal offense in certain situations. The Attorney General can also bring civil actions for violations of the EEA, but until the DTSA was enacted, the EEA didn't authorize private litigants to bring civil action. The second important fact to note is that state law is not uniform, despite the implication that it is. The vast majority of U.S. states have adopted some version of what's known as the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, or the UTSA. Depending on whether one counts North Carolina, which has adopted some but not all of the provisions of the UTSA, 47 or 48 states have now adopted the UTSA. The two holdouts, New York and Massachusetts, protect trade secrets through state common law tort claims. But even among the states that have adopted the UTSA, the law isn't uniform. State legislatures have deviated at times from the language of the UTSA, and state courts have followed many different approaches in interpreting similar language. This lack of uniformity has had consequences on trade secret practice for employers and others who seek to protect their trade secrets. The first consequence is a substantive one. Because differences exist from state to state, it can be a challenge for employers to maintain uniform trade secrets policies and practices across 50 very different legal systems. The second consequence is procedural. For many reasons, many litigants often believe that federal court is a better forum for trade secrets misappropriation claims. As a general rule, it's easier under the federal system to serve third-party subpoenas. In some jurisdictions, it's also easier to obtain emergency injunctive relief in federal court than it is in state court. But since there was no federal civil cause of action for trade secrets misappropriation prior to the DTSA, litigants usually had no basis to be in federal court unless diversity jurisdiction existed or they had some other basis for federal jurisdiction, such as bringing a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim. As I'll describe in a few minutes, Congress repeatedly tried to pass federal legislation creating a federal civil cause of action for trade secrets misappropriation, but ultimately failed to do so until the passage of the DTSA, also like Robert mentioned earlier. On the next two slides, we've provided a chart to give you an idea of the substantive differences between the UTSA and the DTSA, which I will explain in course. So as you can see on this slide, the DTSA provides attorney's fees for bad faith claims upon motion made or resisted in bad faith, willful, or malicious misappropriation. The DTSA also provides for ex parte seizures, like Robert was mentioning before, and an application can be brought by a plaintiff without any notice to the adverse party, subject to certain limitations. Injunctions. There must be actual or threatened misappropriation. That may be enjoined, provided the order doesn't prevent a person from entering into an employment relationship, and that conditions placed on such employment shall be based on evidence of threatened misappropriation and not merely on information the person knows, or otherwise conflict with an applicable state law prohibiting restraints on the practice of a lawful profession, trade, or business. Royalties are also available in exceptional circumstances. An injunction may condition future use upon payment of a reasonable royalty for no longer than the period of time for which use could have been prohibited. Compensatory damages are also available for actual loss and for unjust enrichment or reasonable royalty for unauthorized use or disclosure. Exemplary damages are available up to 2 times the amount of actual damages in the event of willful or malicious misappropriation. And in terms of the statute of limitations, the DTSA's limitations period is 3 years. I'm sorry, I forgot to go into the whistleblower immunity provision, which is perhaps one of the most important provisions of the DTSA. The whistleblower immunity provision protects individuals from criminal or civil liability for disclosing a trade secret if it's made in confidence to a government official or to an attorney for the purpose of reporting some violation of the law, or it's disclosed to an attorney for use in court, subject to limitations, of course, by an individual who files a lawsuit for retaliation by an employer for reporting a suspected violation of law. This requires that employers include a notice of such immunity in any agreement with an employee, contractor, or consultant that governs the use of trade secret or confidential information. We will discuss the whistleblower immunity provision more in depth later in this presentation. In comparison, when you look at what the UTSA provides for, attorney's fees are available, just like under the DTSA. However, ex parte seizures are not authorized under the UTSA. Actual or threatened misappropriation may be enjoined. And in exceptional circumstances, an injunction may condition future use upon payment of a reasonable royalty, but for no longer than the period of time for which use could have been prohibited. In terms of compensatory damages, damages for the actual loss and for unjust enrichment or reasonable royalty for unauthorized use or disclosure are available, and exemplary damages are also available for up to 2 times the amount of actual damages only if willful or malicious misappropriation is shown. Again, the statute of limitations is 3 years, and there is no whistleblower immunity provisions under the UTSA. In light of these issues, Congress attempted to harmonize federal law by providing for rules and remedies that would apply across all 50 states and all U.S. territories. Congress finally succeeded in its mission with what became known as the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016. So how did the DTSA come into being? Well, on July 29, 2015, in the Senate, Senators Hatch and Coons introduced the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2015, known then as S-1890, which is based on the Senate's 2014 bill bearing the same name. Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives, Representative Doug Collins from Georgia introduced an identical version of the bill, also called the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2015, but known as H.R. 3326. Even from the beginning, the DTSA of 2015 was a bipartisan, bicameral bill built on previous, though unsuccessful, trade secret legislation. The bill intended to create a private civil action for misappropriation of a trade secret that is related to a product or service used in or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. Such theft was already a federal crime under the EEA I referenced previously. The real significance of this bill was that it would create a new civil cause of action for the misappropriation of trade secrets that does not require the same level of intent as the criminal provisions of the EEA. On December 2, 2015, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing, which we live tweeted, which discussed the importance of trade secrets to American companies, existing remedies to trade secrets owners facing misappropriation of their rights, and the impact a federal civil cause of action would have on trade secret misappropriation. The committee heard testimony from counsel from DuPont, Corning, among others. Later, on March 7th of this year, the Judiciary Committee published a report to accompany S-1890, again the Senate's version of the DTSA bill, that ultimately passed the House and came across Obama's desk last week. Yet in April, the Senate Judiciary Committee considered an amended version of S-1890 in open session. The committee approved S-1890 as amended by a voice vote with no objection. Senators Leahy and Grassley offered another amendment which contained the whistleblower provision that Robert will discuss in just a bit. That amendment was also accepted by a voice vote with no objection. S-1890 was ultimately passed by the Senate Judiciary Committee on April 4th, approved by the House sister committee on April 20th, and then passed the House on April 27th. President Obama signed S-1890 as amended into law last week on May 12th. What then does the DTSA provide, you're probably wondering. The DTSA creates a federal civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation. But can any average Joe complain of such harm? Not quite. The DTSA provides that only the owner of a trade secret may bring a civil claim for trade secret misappropriation. The DTSA further limits the scope of who may bring such a claim by curbing the types of trade secrets that may instigate a federal cause of action. Those types of trade secrets are those related to a product or service used in or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. Essentially, though, so long as a trade secret is used in commerce over which Congress has control, which is almost all types of commerce, a trade secret owner can bring a federal trade secret action for misappropriation under the DTSA. Further, the DTSA contains new definitions of terms like misappropriation and improper means, which we will now more further discuss. The DTSA includes definitions of misappropriation and improper means that generally track the definitions of those terms in the UTSA. As you can see, the term misappropriation means A, acquisition of a trade secret of another by a person who knows or has reason to know that the trade secret was acquired by improper means, which we'll discuss in just a minute, or disclosure or use of a trade secret of another without express or implied consent by a person who used improper means to acquire knowledge of the trade secret, at the time of disclosure or use knew or had reason to know that the knowledge of the trade secret was either derived from or through a person who had used improper means to acquire the trade secret, acquired it under such circumstances giving rise to some sort of duty to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret or limit the use of the secret, or derived from or through a person who owed a duty to the person seeking relief to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret or limit the use of the secret. Or, before a material change of the position of the person knew or had reason to know that the trade secret was in fact a trade secret and knowledge of the trade secret had been acquired by accident or mistake. Improper means, as you can see, was used quite a bit in the definition of misappropriation, includes theft, bribery, misrepresentation, breach or inducement of a breach of a duty to maintain secrecy or espionage through electronic or other means. And it does not include reverse engineering, independent derivation, or any other lawful means of acquisition. Furthermore, the term trade secret just means all forms and types of financial, business, scientific, technical, economic, or engineering information, such as patterns, plans, compilations, program devices, formulas. I won't list the entire list as you can see there, but you should also notice that it doesn't matter if they're tangible or intangible, whether or how they're stored, compiled, or memorialized, whether physically, electronically, or otherwise, if the owner thereof has taken reasonable measures to keep such information secret, and the information derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known to and not readily ascertainable through proper means by the public. I'll now turn the presentation back to Robert, who will detail the unique provisions of the DTSA and introduce new litigation strategies in light of the DTSA.
Thanks, Amy. I think one significant thing to call out is that the term trade secret under the Defend Trade Secret Act is broader than the definition of trade secret under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So more information that may have not been covered under the UTSA can be captured under the DTSA. Specifically, the statute provides that information can be in your memory. So there's a lot of action when it comes to employee-employer litigation and whether, you know, information that's stored in someone's memory could be considered a trade secret. And under the term trade secret defined under the Economic Espionage Act, information that's in someone's memory can qualify as a trade secret. So in that aspect, it contains a broader definition than under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Let's move on to some of the other features of the Defend Trade Secret Act. In general, the remedies are consistent with the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Of course, injunctive relief is available, and actual and threatened misappropriation of trade secrets can be enjoined. Now, there were some limitations put on injunctions that would interfere with someone's ability to obtain employment with a new company, and there's a limitation that there has to be evidence of threatened misappropriation, and the injunction can't be merely on information that the person knows. And that was particular language that was requested by Senator Feinstein from California. There's also limitations on the injunction that in court can impose upon an employee. It's not to interfere with their ability under state law to pursue their right to pursue their trade or profession. And so that's going to be highly significant in California because I think that people that are defending these cases will argue that you can't impose under a violation of the Defend Trade Secret Act for any sort of restrictive covenant or non-compete as a result of the trade secret misappropriation. And so that's a somewhat unique in the sense that states that have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act, in some states you can obtain an injunction for under an inevitable disclosure type theory. And so it's quite clear that under the Defend Trade Secrets Act that you would not be able to pursue a inevitable disclosure theory. So that is another key distinguishing element, that the remedy is a little bit limited for injunctive relief under the Defend Trade Secret Act. Of course, you can get actual damages, exemplary damages, up to two times. One thing important to point out is that the statute of limitations is 3 years. There's some variety among states under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Some have a 3-year statute of limitations. Other states have a 5-year statute of limitations. And so the Defend Trade Secret Act takes a middle ground of the 3 years. And attorney's fees are available, and they can be available on either as a plaintiff or a defendant. For the plaintiff, they're going to need to show willful and malicious misappropriation of the trade secret. And then for the defendant can recover their fees if they can show that the trade secret claim was brought in bad faith. And so that can be significant in trade secret litigation as far as whether your ability, if you're able to recover attorney's fees. And then reasonable royalties are available in lieu of damages caused by misappropriation. That's also a remedy under the Defend Trade Secrets Act. As far as the unique, unique provisions, we talked a little bit about the statute of limitations, but I think one of the key unique features is the ex parte seizure of property. And it's clear from the statute that this particular ex parte seizure is only to be used in extraordinary circumstances to prevent the dissemination of the trade secret. And practically what this would mean would be that you would put together your papers and you would be requesting of the court that without notice to the defendant that the misappropriated property be seized by a federal marshal. And that would be the first time that the defendant would know that a lawsuit had been filed against them and that the court would be executing the order seizing the misappropriated goods. But the court goes through a very detailed balancing test before they would issue any sort of injunctive relief in that regard. Obviously, you're going to need to show that the information is a trade secret. You also need to show that Rule 65, which is the injunction statute under the federal rules, or the injunction rule under the federal rules, is not sufficient. That this ex parte seizure is what is required there. And so I think that there's going to definitely be some cases where the ex parte seizure is going to be used. But it's really for the special type case where perhaps you have someone that is fleeing the country who's misappropriated goods, and they're fleeing the country, and there's a threat that they're going to share them with another nation state or start their own company abroad, and there's concern that they would be destroying evidence, and those would be instances where you may be able to convince a federal judge to issue the ex parte seizure order. But in general, it's going to be one of those remedies that's only going to be called for very special and unique type cases. Some of the other unique provisions that haven't been getting a lot of press is that for criminal misappropriation of trade secrets, there's increased penalties. They've increased the penalties from $5 million to $5 million, or three times the value of the stolen trade secret. And that's significant because it takes us back to where does the statute come from? And the original and Economic Espionage Act criminalizes trade secret misappropriation, and this civil addition to the Economic Espionage Act takes on some of the definitions of the Economic Espionage Act that was already on the books, namely, the definition of a trade secret. There is another interesting provision that may be useful, particularly in competitive disputes amongst competitors where there's, repeat allegations of trade secret misappropriation, corporate rating type claims. And that provision, it allows it amends the RICO statute to add a violation of the Economic Espionage Act as a predicate act under the RICO statute. And there's also a provision that allows trade secret owners to be heard in criminal court concerning the need to protect their trade secrets. And that's significant because sometimes during criminal investigations, companies may receive subpoenas from the government agencies, and while they may want to cooperate or bring a motion to quash, ultimately they have concerns about, even if they comply with the subpoena, they want to make sure that there's going to be safeguards about the use and dissemination of the trade secrets. And this particular provision allows trade secret owners to have the ability to go to court to seek a protective order before their trade secrets are disclosed. And when you look at this as a whole, what type of strategies in trade secret litigation in this new world does this mean? Well, some of the things are clear. Number one, you can bring a claim in federal court under the Defend Trade Secret Act. At the same time, you can have a companion claim for a violation of the Uniform Trade Secret Act in your particular state. And depending upon the state, you can also bring a common law claim if in your jurisdiction, common law claims are not preempted. And so there's going to be a calculus that's going to be done about whether you want to file in state or in federal court. Now, The Defend Trade Secret Act provides for original jurisdiction. It doesn't provide for exclusive jurisdiction. So you could bring your suit in state court for the violation of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, but that particular action could be promptly removed to federal court based upon original jurisdiction. But in general, you'll probably see more cases, trade secret cases, filed in federal court than we've seen in the past. In the past, your only ability to do that was based upon diversity jurisdiction. Now, some of the caveats about why you may not want to choose a federal forum is that a unanimous jury is required in federal court. So from a plaintiff's perspective, if it's going to be a jury trial, you're going to have to get a unanimous a jury verdict in order to be successful in civil court. So that may be a reason why you'd choose state court. But typically, you're looking for injunctive relief. So you may feel that you have a better chance of getting injunctive relief before the federal court as opposed to the state court. Another thing that you would take into account is that, as we made mention, is that there's not going to be the ability to get an injunction for inevitable disclosure under the Defend Trade Secrets Act. So you may want to bring a claim under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act for inevitable disclosure if your jurisdiction allows it. And it's conceivable that that could be in federal court. You could bring a claim for under the Defend Trade Secrets Act and under the Uniform Trade Secret Act and seek that remedy under the state law claim. Another interesting aspect that you're going to see, much like copyright, patent, and trademark law, is that you may see more declaratory relief actions brought against brought by individuals, companies, and employees who are concerned that specious claims are being brought about the possession of trade secrets or that information qualifies as a trade secret. So what that means is that an employee or a defendant who has concerns that someone's going to claim that they misappropriated trade secrets can get access to the federal courts and bring a declaratory relief action. And there's going to be some strategy involved in that because they may want to have it situated in their home forum as opposed to the trade secret owner's forum. And it may be because in their home forum, that particular jurisdiction does not recognize inevitable disclosure and is a more pro-employee friendly jurisdiction. Maybe it prohibits non-competes or it narrowly construes its trade secret laws. And so we may see some forum shopping and we may be seeing typical trade secret defendants offensively bringing declaratory relief claims under the DTSA. Forum is going to be a key under this particular new law, selecting which forum that you want to sue in, sort of along the lines we were talking about as far as shopping for the right court for your case, whether you want to be in state court, whether you want to be in federal court, and what particular state that you want to be in. There's going to be some strategy calls based upon whether you're the plaintiff or the defendant in these type of cases. Another key aspect is in trade secret litigation, in a state such as California, there's a requirement to identify your trade secret with particularity if you're a trade secret owner and a trade secret plaintiff before discovery commences. In other jurisdictions, there's no such requirement. And so it's going to be significant as to whether federal judges are going to graft on a identification requirement as part of the Rule 26 disclosures as far as an identification of the trade secrets that were misappropriated, and if such an identification is not provided, whether there's going to be limits and contours on the ability of a plaintiff to pursue discovery in those cases. And these are only going to be worked out as the case law develops. We expect that the federal courts will probably use some of the state court decisions construing the Uniform Trade Secret Act, but we're essentially dealing with a brand new statute with no existing case law construing it. So you can expect that some federal judges will rely upon some of the older Uniform Trade Secret Act decisions in construing what they should do in dealing with this new statute. One of the unique provisions under the Defend Trade Secret Act is the whistleblower immunity provisions. And it was put in place to protect individuals from criminal or civil liability for disclosing a trade secret if it is made in confidence to a government official, directly or indirectly, or to an attorney, and is made for the purposes of reporting a violation of law. So that is the requirement in order for this immunity provision to be invoked. There is an affirmative duty on employers to provide employees with notice of this new immunity provision in any contract or agreement with an employee that governs the use of a trade secret or other confidential information. Now, I think it's significant to point out that the definition of an employee under this statute includes a contractor and consultant work done by an individual for an employer. So we're getting questions about, well, does it apply to business partners? And under this particular statute, it doesn't apply to business partners. It applies in the employment context. So if you're using contractors and consultants as an employer, it applies, but not between third-party business partners. And then another common question that we're getting is, well, what about an employee that signed a non-disclosure agreement before the passage of the statute? Do I need to have them sign a new agreement? And the answer to that question is no, you're not required to, but you may want to, particularly in the future, if you plan on rolling out new non-disclosure agreements anyway, you'll definitely going to want to include the whistleblower immunity provision on a going forward basis for new rollouts of an agreement. Just to be clear, with respect to new employees, the best practice is to ask new employees to sign non-disclosure agreements that contains the whistleblower immunity language. And we'll get into some of the model language that you should include in your non-disclosure agreements going forward. Now, under the particular statute, in lieu of having the whistleblower immunity provision in your non-disclosure agreements, the statute also says that you can cross-reference your policy on whistleblower protections in your agreement. And you can cross-reference the employee to that particular policy that lays out what your whistleblower protections are. Now, there's some ambiguity there, but what we think the best reading of that would mean that in your non-disclosure agreement, you would cross-reference the policy, and then your policy would have the magic language that's required under this particular statute. And what is the recourse if you do not include this particular language? Well, for one, if you don't include this particular language with your new employees on a going forward basis, and you later want to sue one of those new employees for trade secret misappropriation under the Defend Trade Secret Act, you would not be able to recover your attorney's fees or exemplary damages under the Defend Trade Secret Act. So that's at least one of the incentives. So what should your strategy be on a going forward basis in light of this whistleblower immunity requirement? You're going to want to update your non-disclosure agreements with new employees, contractors, and consultants immediately to include the magic language. And that can also include consultant agreements, severance agreements, any type of agreement where you're asking an employee, contractor, or consultant to enter into an agreement to protect confidential information or trade secrets. That's where you're going to want to include the whistleblower immunity language. So the magic language that we've been referring to, what kind of language should you use? And as you can see on the screen, and it goes across several slides, but this is the language that we're looking and telling our clients to include in their agreements on a going forward basis. So it's providing notice of immunity under the Defend Trade Secret Act. The employee is acknowledging and agreeing that the company has provided the employee with written notice of the Defend Trade Secret Act. and it's actually using the language of the statute in providing the employee with notice of that immunity. And so this is the actual language from the statute. So this is the belt and suspenders approach in light of the fact that there hasn't been any case law construing what a sufficient or an appropriate disclosure is. And so the belt and suspender approach is to actually include the magic language from the and the statutory language from the Defend Trade Secret Act itself. So it's those two components. And obviously you're going to be provided a copy of this slide, but this is what we call the whistleblower immunity language. Provision one, the immunity, and then provision two, the use of trade secret information in an anti-retaliation lawsuit. Now, obviously, we have clients that are saying, well, that language is too cumbersome. Do we really have to use the statutory language itself? Can we paraphrase it? Can we whittle it down a little bit? And the answer to that is you can, but you're going to probably do it at your own peril since there's not a lot of guidance about what is exactly sufficient. And so for some alternative language, which condenses the obligation, you'll see on the screen in front of you some pared-down language that paraphrases what the obligation, what the whistleblower immunity language provides. And the third approach was what we refer to earlier is the statute itself allows you to cross-reference your whistleblowing policy. So first off, you're going to want to make sure you have a whistleblowing policy if you want to avail yourself of that third alternative. And in the whistleblowing policy, you're going to want to make sure that you either use the statutory language itself or this alternative magic language that you see on the screen here. And your agreement is going to want to refer the employee to your policy on whistleblowing protection. Now, again, to reiterate some of the basics here, does this mean you need to have all existing employees provide them with a new agreement with their whistleblower immunity protection? The answer is no. The answer is you may want to if out of your ordinary course you are updating your non-disclosure agreement, but certainly for new employees, contractors, and consultants, you are going to want to include the whistleblower immunity language. And so some of the takeaways for HR professionals and labor and employment attorneys, well, what should I do? One of the things is, apart from adding the whistleblower immunity language, it's also a good time to take a look at your non-disclosure agreement in general and making sure that that particular agreement fits your company. Have you adequately defined and disclosed what you consider to be your trade secrets? Have you got your principals at the company in a meeting, in a room, and sat down and said, this is what we consider to be our trade secret information? Or are you just using some form that you found on the internet that doesn't really fit your business, how you conduct your business, and are you relying upon that? So it's a really good opportunity to sit down with the business and get a good handle about whether you're adequately describing what your trade secrets are. Because once you understand and identify what your trade secrets are, then you can do a survey of how you're going about protecting that particular secret information. Because again, you know, this statute is providing companies with a federal property right that they didn't otherwise have. So now trade secrets are on the same plane as copyrights, trademarks, and patents as far as a federally protected, you know, right. So it's certainly, our recommendation that you have that discourse with the business and that you you really identify, you know, what type of trade secret information your company may have and include examples of that information in your non-disclosure agreement, and then do an audit of how you are protecting that type of information. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan Hart to get into our next material.
Well, thank you, Robert. And before I get started here, I'd like to provide the code for anyone who is seeking CLE credit for this webinar. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS7084. Again, that is SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 7084. Now, we've been talking about the benefits of the DTSA throughout this webinar, but I think it's important to keep in mind that the DTSA is not helpful to companies unless they take reasonable measures to keep their trade secrets confidential. And one of the most important ways that companies can protect their trade secrets is through their IT policies. In recent years, bring your own device or BYOD policies have become the norm at probably most companies, and no one can doubt that these policies have a lot of benefits. It's hard to imagine conducting business these days without smartphones or other devices, and there can be considerable cost savings to companies in allowing employees to bring their own devices to work instead of the company having to pay for the cost of the devices. But these policies do have a significant downside because they create another layer of complexity that wouldn't apply if the company owns a device. If the company owns a device, you can insist that the employee return the device with all the data on it at the end of his or her employment. Not necessarily the case if the employee is the one who owns the device. And so if you decide as a company to have a BYOD policy, it should be a thoughtful and customized policy. The policy ideally should cover ownership of the data on the device. It should specify which devices are included in the policy. And the policy also needs to be integrated with the exit interview process, which I'm going to talk about in a little more detail in a minute. You really ought to anticipate at the outset that as a company, you may need the employee to provide access to his or her device at the end of the employment relationship, in order to ensure that the company's information has been removed from the device. And so the policy ought to state that clearly. And it's also important to ensure that the policy is compliant with all applicable privacy laws and regulations. And so in this regard, it's very important to have qualified counsel review the policy. The same thing applies to security procedures, both for IT resources and other resources generally. And at risk of stating the obvious, all employers can and should take common sense measures to include that their trade secrets and proprietary information are protected from disclosure. And some of the preventative measures include storing hard copies of sensitive information in locked closets or drawers. Again, it might be obvious, but something that sometimes is overlooked. Limiting the ability to print sensitive documents or access them remotely. Limiting access to the company's crown jewels to employees with a business need for access to them. Monitoring access and use of IT resources while certainly complying with all applicable privacy laws. Encrypting data. And finally, putting password protections on documents. These are all common sense approaches that ought to be taken in order to ensure that companies are using measures that are reasonable under the circumstances to keep their trade secrets confidential. I've already touched on this somewhat, but the exit interview and termination process is another important consideration. Employers should make sure that the exit interview was coordinated among all organizations of the company that need to be involved, and that's perhaps most importantly IT and HR. Again, this might be an obvious point, but IT should ensure that all company property, hardware, and devices have been returned at the conclusion of employment, and that would include email and cloud data and any company data in social media accounts. IT should also ensure that arrangements have been made to have all company data removed from personal devices and that the employee's access to the computer network has been disabled. Consider requiring employees to sign a certification that they have returned all company property in their possession, custody, or control, and that includes all company information that's in their personal email accounts, cloud-based accounts, Google Drive, etc. In addition, it's a good idea to check an employee's computer activities and work activities in advance of the exit interview. And this is especially the case if you have reason to believe that the employee is going to work for a competitor. Again, this might be an obvious point, but it's a good idea to expressly remind employees of their continuing obligations to the company during the exit interview. You might also consider sending a letter to the employee and his or her new employer that reminds them of the employee's continuing obligations, and you might perhaps require the employee to provide a written certification of his or her compliance. And depending on the level of the employee and the likelihood of litigation, you might also consider having the employee's emails preserved, and you might have the employee's computer forensically imaged to see if there's any evidence of misappropriation of trade secrets. Now, finally, with enactment of the DTSA, it's prudent to anticipate some likely trends on the litigation front. And with any new cause of action which has no guiding precedent, there are bound to be some issues and potential pitfalls in litigating such claims. One anticipated issue is the potential uptick in declaratory judgment actions in federal court. As Robert already mentioned, in defending against a DTSA claim, a defendant could seek a declaratory judgment that effectively finds that the information that's in question is not a trade secret as defined by the DTSA. And so employers should expect that they may encounter more race to the courthouse scenarios now that the DTSA has been enacted. Another potential pitfall to keep in mind in determining strategy is that an alleged trade secret misappropriator still has the reverse engineering defense available to him or to her. Additionally, as Robert mentioned earlier, there's no preemption clause in the DTSA. Congress could have chosen to preempt the field when it comes to misappropriation of trade secrets related to interstate commerce. They expressly chose not to do that, and that means that a party can bring a DTSA claim along with any actionable state law claims, which will vary from state to state. And if a state law UTSA claim is brought in such a litigation, then depending on the state you're in, some additional state common law claims may not be available. The UTSA has language stating that it displaces other civil claims for misappropriation of trade secrets other than claims for breach of contract. And in some states, the courts have interpreted that language broadly to bar any common law claims for misappropriation of any kind of confidential information, even if the information does not rise to the level of a trade secret. And because the DTSA does not preempt state law is going to continue to govern the extent to which, under the UTSA, other common law claims have been displaced. And finally, as Robert already mentioned, although federal courts have original jurisdiction over DTSA claims, there is no exclusive jurisdiction. And so a plaintiff pursuing a DTSA could choose to do so either in federal or state court, and that's regardless of whether or not the plaintiff is asserting state law causes of action in addition to the DTSA claim. Now, if the plaintiff decides to file a DTSA claim in state court, the defendant will always be able to remove that action on the basis of federal question jurisdiction, even if there's no diversity of citizenship. But the defendant's going to have to remove within the time period allowed by statute for the removal of the case. And so for this reason, defendants will need to be vigilant in timely removing claims to federal court, or else they'll be stuck in state court. And there might be some situations where a plaintiff decides to bring the case in state court and a defendant decides that as a matter of strategy, they are better off in state court and decide not to remove. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of today's presentation. And before I hand it off to Robert for the conclusion, I'd like to refer you to our trade secrets blog, www.tradesecretslaw.com, where we've been tracking the DTSA since it was first introduced in Congress. As always, we'll continue to blog on the latest developments in trade secret law and related topics. And so please check out our blog for the latest legal news and practical pointers. And with that, I'll hand it back over to Robert to conclude our webinar today.
Thanks, Dan. We got some good questions that I like to go over, and those who want to get some additional questions in, this would be a good time to go ahead and send those in. But just to sum up our two main takeaways, this new law is significant in creating a new federal property right. And that's significant to businesses that are looking for ways to further their own interests. And then number two, just from a technical and an HR employment type perspective, there are new obligations under this whistleblower immunity provision that companies should implement. One of the questions that came up is, when does the act go into effect? In other words, if somebody misappropriated your trade secret, when can you sue them for actions that have occurred in the past, or is it only as of a certain date? And the answer is that misappropriation as of the date the bill was signed, which was May 11th, would be actionable under the DTSA, because it was it applies to any act that occurs on or after the date of enactment, and it was enacted on May 11th. Now, with respect to the notice requirement under the statute, that is obviously the whistleblower immunity notice, it applies to contracts and agreements that are entered into or updated after the date of the enactment. So as of May 12th, employers should be providing notice of the whistleblower immunity to new employees, contractors, and consultants. We had a question, and I think we may have covered this. Do you think that the non-disclosure agreements typically used between companies have to be changed in view of the DTSA? That's going to play out in the courts, but I think that the notice requirement applies to employees, and it's not for businesses that are doing business with each other. Of course, that can be a little bit tricky where since the definition of employee also includes contractors and consultants, the specific language of the statute says that it's consultants and contractors performing work for an employer. And the definition of the statute doesn't define an individual, and it doesn't define an entity. So, I think it's going to be a disputed issue, but I think, a fair reading of the statute is that it would just apply to individual employees and individual contractors as opposed to separate companies. But, the courts will have to decide that one. The other question we had is, and Dan, maybe you can cover this one, or I can jump in if need be, but are customer lists and related information protected under the DTSA as they are under the UTSA?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's going to largely depend on the circumstances. The short of the answer is that it can be potentially covered under the DTSA. As Robert mentioned earlier, the definition of the DTS, of trade secret under the DTSA, which comes from the existing language of the EEA, is broader than the language under the UTSA. Having said that, the UTSA varies from state to state. In Georgia, for example, customer lists are included in the definition. That's not the case in other states. I think with respect to the DTSA, it's going to largely depend on whether the information in question has been kept confidential and reasonable measures have been taken to preserve the confidentiality. And so it's going to largely be a fact-based question.
Yeah, and I think the answer is yes, they can be. You're right, because there's a broad definition under the Economic Espionage Act of what a trade secret is. All forms and types of business, financial, scientific, technical, economic, or engineering information. So a customer list would qualify, but under your, like you're saying, under your facts and circumstances, it's really going to boil down to that and whether you took reasonable secrecy measures. And another question, Dan, is do you expect that there's going to be a significant uptick in the number of cases that are filed in federal court?
Yeah, I think that's certainly going to be the case. And I think, frankly, that was what was intended by Congress, to create a federal remedy here in federal court. I think the bottom line is federal court is going to be the typical forum for litigating trade secrets claims.
And then we had a question here about, what's the applicability to government employees
when a government entity is the holder of the trade secret, who would the government employee report to if they want to be a whistleblower? I don't see any exclusion for governmental employees, so I think that they would have to provide this immunity protection as well. But as far as who they'd have to report to, I think to the extent that there already isn't a requirement under the laws, they would have to have some sort of internal entity handle that. Any thoughts on that, Dan?
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to largely depend on what agency is at issue here. Each federal agency has their own internal reporting procedures, and presumably the federal agencies and state agencies are already coming up with a new policy or procedure for reporting if they haven't already rolled that out yet.
Yeah. Another question is, well, so what if I don't comply with this notice of requirement? What is that? What are the consequences? And that's gonna play itself out. But I mean, you can say at a minimum, if you want to sue, this employee, contractor, or consultant, you're not gonna be able to get your attorney's fees or your double damages. But I think also, what's going on here is government agencies are cracking down on overly broad non-disclosure agreements. And they may point to this notice requirement as evidence that you have overly broad agreements, and you're trying to, chill an employee's ability to report corporate wrongdoing. You could envision a scenario where the FTC or attorney generals might try to use this notice requirement as evidence of a part and parcel of an agreement and a practice, to chill employees from reporting wrongdoing. Certainly, that's been an initiative of the Obama administration, and as the election plays itself out, it'll be interesting to see if that continues to be a objective of the government. Any thoughts there, Dan?
I think that's a good prediction of what's going to happen here. Even putting aside the loss of some damages that you otherwise could get, not including the magic language as we've discussed it today, is just one more reason why a government agency or, frankly, a defendant in a case would try to argue that the agreement that you are trying to enforce is simply overbroad.
Yeah.
And so it's better to have the language in there.
Yeah, and I think that if your company is, regularly updates your non-disclosure agreement, like on an annual or a routine basis, it's a no-brainer on a going forward basis to include the whistleblower immunity language going forward. All right. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any additional questions. You'll be getting a copy of the slide deck as well as the immunity language. And we have put together a frequently asked question document that we hope to circulate as well. Again, thanks for your time, and have a great day. Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending. You may now disconnect.